Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at openhousecommunity.com.au.
I could quite easily take up the rest of tonight's program speaking with my next fascinating, absorbing guest. I must confess, for me, part of it's personal, but more importantly, it's about passion and it's about music. In fact, I doubt I've ever met a more passionate person, and my knowledge of him actually goes back some 45 years. Richard Gill is an Australian classical music legend. His vast range of musical experiences stretches from a high school teacher, a series of roles in Australian opera, conducting the Sydney Symphony Orchestra. He's the founder of the magnificent Baby Proms. He wrote a top 40 song. He conducted David Helfgott's first spectacular return concert. He's been a regular on Spicks and Specks. It goes on and on. And along the way, he stepped on a fair few toes. A fair few have stepped on his. He's known plots, scheming, and dramas worthy of their own opera. Perhaps his greatest passion is music and children, for which I am forever so thankfully in his debt. And when you learn of Richard's early days, especially his fearful, brutalized, traumatized childhood at school, you'll wonder how he ever made it through it all. I think that, on its own, is a vitally important story for us to hear. Richard is married to Maureen, and they have two children, Claire and Anthony, who've been on board for a roller coaster of a ride. At the age of 72, Richard Gill has had his memoir published, entitled Give Me Excess of It. I'm so glad to say, Richard Gill, welcome to Open House.
Thank you very much, Lee. It's lovely to be here with you.
Wonderful for you to join us. It's a treat. I'd like to begin with that title. Can you explain where it came from and why that was the title of your choice?
Give Me Excess of It came from the opening lines of Twelfth Night. If music be the food of love, play on, give me excess of it. And it goes on then to say, dilly dilly, or I die. The title, I think, is also reflects me a little bit because I am a creature of excess. You know, moderation is not in my vocabulary, and that's something from which I've suffered, but that's fine. And the publishers liked it, and so we went with it.
Good stuff. Have you ever contemplated what a world without music would be like? Because for us to have life sustained, you don't actually need to have music to live.
Look, I understand that, but my view is that would be a life less rich. I can only answer that question by saying no, I haven't ever contemplated a life without music.
Doesn't surprise me.
No, because it's been so much part of my life for as long as I can remember.
You were no child prodigy, though. It wasn't until 13 that you began formal lessons. But you were finally intoxicated by the music and ceremony of the Roman Catholic Mass.
That was how music came to me in a spectacular way. And you're absolutely right. I was never a child prodigy. I went to school just after the end of World War II. The Mass was still in Latin. The altars hadn't been turned around. The church hadn't lost its way, so to speak. And there was still an element of mystery and ritual, etc. Priests dressed up and there were altar boys and there was incense and bells and smells and whistles in the choir and all that sort of stuff. So it was theatre. As far as I was concerned, it was a real theatrical production. And when I heard that music, when I heard that singing, that absolutely resonated with me in a spectacular way. And I started to learn those things from memory because everything we were taught in those days was pretty well done by rote. So particularly music.
You actually built an altar in your backyard, isn't
it? I did. Yes. I think I probably wanted to be the Pope at some stage, Lee. I did build an altar in my backyard because I love the idea of being in charge, the idea of being up the front. I used to wave my arms around and say Dominus Vobiscum or sing Dominus Vobiscum. I had the girl next door, her name was Wilma. She was relegated to behind the altar because in those days women were not allowed on the altar. And so Wilma played on a piece of corrugated iron with a stick. She banged on this corrugated iron. That was the organ. I would give the sermon, and I would frequently preach to the chooks because the altar was built near a chook yard.
Classic. So, Hail Mary, Mother of Grapes.
Exactly.
That's one of the lines.
Yeah, the Hail Mary full of grapes, because that's what I thought it was. I mean, we all know the Hail Mary is Hail Mary full of grace. Blessed is the fruit of thy womb. So grapes and fruit of thy womb were very powerful images for a young child.
I get it. There was one moment with a man called Brother Tom, and I want to explore your traumatic school life shortly, but at the age of 8, you were tinkering on a piano at school.
So you really have read the book, Lee?
Oh, yes. Especially this one.
I was fooling around with the piano, and this brother, and we call him Brother Tom, gave me four cuts of the cane because I was interfering with other people's property. You know, the piano was at the back of the room. It was in a classroom. And you would think, had he not wanted me to play the piano, he might have said, look, do you mind closing the piano? Or we're having a class or something. But no, I was interfering with someone else's property. So I got four cuts straight away.
It didn't deter you, though.
No, it didn't deter me.
Why not?
Because punishment of that nature was commonplace. I didn't know any different. I'd known as a very young child that fear seemed to be very much associated with learning. That was normal. Mm. Being punished for all sorts of things was normal.
For your first music lessons, you actually had to beg, borrow and steal, but they also came to a rather unfortunate ending with your first teacher.
I was desperate to go along and have a lesson. Desperate.
Yeah.
And my father took me up to the lesson. She asked me to put my hands on the piano. And as I placed my hands on the piano, she shrieked, like, get your hands off the keyboard. Get your hands off. What are those things on the back of your hand? And my hands were covered in warts. And when I was nervous, they would inflame. They'd go red, like neon lights. And I said, oh, they're warts. She said, oh, you'll infect the piano. That was the end of that.
You had a tough time.
Yeah, that was the end of that. So no more lessons. Well, no, I didn't have one lesson with her. We didn't get beyond the warts.
Tell me about this day, 28th of June, 1955,
mm-hmm.
Your first piano arrives at home.
My youngest brother's birthday. My youngest brother's name is Chris, and it was his birthday, and I'd come home from school, and there was a piano that had been delivered during the day, which was amazing.
Yeah.
It was an old Steck, a duo art piano, like a pianola, in a terrible condition. And lots of the ivory in those days, it was ivory, had come off the keys, but I didn't care. This was an instrument. It was like heaven. And then I actually started having lessons. I got a job part-time to save up money to have the piano repaired, which I did. I saved up enough money to have the piano repaired. It became quite a reasonable instrument.
Fast forward, what drew you to music education and not performance?
I thought I would be a performer at some stage, until, of course, I was told I would never be a performer, really. But I didn't ever feel that teaching was a bad second. I did my very first high school prac at Marsden High School in 1962, and I'll never, ever forget that experience. That's when I knew that teaching was really special, that there was something about teaching that attracted me really, really powerfully. And the idea of convincing adolescents that music was a worthwhile pursuit for its own sake was completely and utterly irresistible. And I was hooked on music education from that moment.
Marsden, and this is where I have to declare my special interest in me, that was my old high school. We crossed over for 2 years.
We did indeed.
Two delightful years. It was such a critical time for you, but it was just an ordinary Western Sydney high school.
It was, but it was, there was something extraordinary about it because there were an enormous number of students involved in music, as you know. And I wrote two operas for the students at the school who took part in them willingly and saw that as absolutely normal. Composition was very much part of the life of the school as well as classroom lessons. The general interest in music from the school and the school community was really, really strong. And we were seen as one of the leading music schools in the state.
I must say that one of those musicals was a trailblazing Aboriginal rock opera. This is 1969.
Yeah.
Jinini,
yes.
When I look back on that, so many decades later, for that time, that was extraordinary.
Yeah, no one was doing things like that.
No,
so
no.
The boy who wrote the text was a boy called Gavin Gosso, who wrote the libretto, and he was in year 12 at the time. And it was a very good text. I mean, we put two Aboriginal legends together and turned it into an opera for the kids. Everybody took part in it. It wasn't perceived as an extraordinary event. It was perceived for what it was, something we were doing in the school as part of education.
For the kids then, and what's driven you in the decades that followed, especially with education and music, why do kids need music? What's so important about it?
I think the thing that is important about music is because it operates in the abstract, that music is quintessentially an abstract art. It takes kids to a very, very high level of thinking. Music doesn't describe, it doesn't tell stories, it doesn't do anything outside itself, but it may suggest, imply, evoke any number of things at the most intensely personal level. That is a powerful tool for the imagination of a child, for the mind of a child, and also music being an oral art. Children have to focus, concentrate, listen very hard. While these are not reasons for teaching music, they are bonuses in the sense that business of concentration, the business of focus, the business of honing in while you're listening to music overlaps into all other areas of learning.
It actually activates areas of the brain different from lots of other learning.
Correct.
Yes.
I'm no neuroscientist, but I do know, I read quite widely on this topic, and we do know that the neuroscientists are very, very interested in why music operates differently from all the other arts, and particularly when a child is reading. Now, I know you learn jazz guitar and you play drums and all that sort of thing. So when you're playing guitar and maybe even singing or reading music from the guitar, both sides of your brain light up.
Yes.
And not only do they light up in a rapid sequence from side to side all over the brain. And we know that that has really powerful effect on all other areas of learning.
Yes.
Now, I separate that from the reasons for teaching music, because I believe we teach music because it's good and that's enough. But for politicians and parents, you need other motivating forces.
Yeah.
Because of this intensity in the listening and the focus and the concentration, the benefits for all other parts of learning are extraordinary.
You went on from Marsden to the UK, to America, into the worlds of conducting and your great passion for opera. What did you take away from Marsden?
From Marsden, I sowed the seeds really for the rest of my life. I got some very, and I say got very, very deliberately, I got some very strong lessons in teaching. I learned, for example, that telling somebody that something is good does not convince them. They have to find that out for themselves. Mm. I was taught that lesson very quickly by students, particularly one. I also learned that it is imperative to encourage children to think and to learn how to learn, to learn how to think and to learn how to learn, and that your views of the music are irrelevant. What is most interesting is what they have to say about the music. I further learned that all music can be used to some degree to teach some children something. There is no benefit or moral high ground in playing Mozart to children. Classical music does not have the moral high ground. There's an enormous wealth of music from the year 800, if you like, to now. The richness of the repertoire is in hip-hop and pop and rock and jazz and folk and opera and classical. It's extraordinary. All of it's good. Like, there's a lot of rubbish, but that's fine. We don't mind the rubbish because once we learn things, we can determine, I don't need that, I don't want that. Mm-hmm. And so I learned again from Marsden the idea that if you can teach a child to discriminate and encourage a child to be wise about choices, that's an important lesson.
You also took away from Marsden a wife.
Yes,
we've got
true.
To mention Maureen. And yeah, there's this touching dedication to your book. Without Maureen, there would have been no memories.
That's true. Well, the thing is, when I was writing the book, it's not that I didn't think about Maureen, but when I was writing the book, the editor who was working with me said, look, we know lots about music, we know lots about your dog, Louie, but we haven't heard much about your wife. So, that's how that came
She's
in.
She's very special.
Yes, she is. I know I could not have done anything that I have done without her. I really do know that. And that's why the dedication goes the way it goes.
On Open House, we're with Richard Gill. Richard, I made mention of it earlier, but I think it is important for us to hear of your early school life and its impact on you. And really, that impact has continued for the rest of your life. This is a Roman Catholic school in the late 40s through to the 50s. Beginning when you were five, describe for us what that was like for you as a kid of five.
I was desperate to go to school. What I wasn't prepared for was the savagery and the violence, if you like, of the teaching. And it was savage. There's no question about that, because we were, even as very young children, there was a type of psychological abuse that I didn't recognize as psychological abuse. I was five, for crying out loud. I didn't recognize anything. I thought that's what it was. That's what you got. And we had, for example, in my very, very first class, taught by a nun, the children were divided into three blocks, VG, G, and H, very good, good, and hopeless. And I was in the back row of the hopeless block. Now, I was one of the youngest kids in the class. I didn't know what it meant. I didn't know what hopeless was. And obviously it wasn't very good, because I wasn't in the very goods and I wasn't in the goods. But what did hopeless really mean?
This is when you were five.
Yeah. So the Catholic Church is having a very bad time at the moment. And I have to say, it's about time that the Catholic Church has a very bad time. But not just the Catholic Church, but all institutions that abuse kids, not just sexually, but psychologically and physically. I was caned when I went to Maris Brothers Eastwood. I, along with lots of other kids, was caned every day of my life from the age of 7 to the age of 15. Some of those canings were for ignorance. In other words, you didn't know something, so you were caned.
For instance, a wrong answer to mental arithmetic.
Correct. And one stage, apropos of mental arithmetic, I had a doctor visit me at home at my mother's request, because she thought I had leukemia, because I was grey and God knows what else. There was nothing wrong with me. And I had a blood test and I was absolutely fine. But the doctor said, is he allergic to school? Which was a sort of a joke. And the idea was, yes, it was, because every day opened with mental arithmetic. And I couldn't do it. The brother would say, in third class or fourth class, whatever it was, and he'd say, 4 + 5 + 6 + 2 - 3 / 4. You know, and I'd have no idea, and I'd just blurt out the first thing that came into my head, like 11, and it would be wrong, and of course I'd be caned straight away.
Caned for it.
Yeah, and then I could relax, because after mental arithmetic, there was spelling, so I could spell like a champion. Then there was written arithmetic. Well, that was worse. I just got the idea that you were caned and punished as part of life. And then we had the psychological abuse in the form of hell and the form of our souls were eternally black. If you thought a sin, you have already committed the sin, so you had to confess that you had evil thoughts. I can't tell you, Lee, my mind was so screwed up. By the time I got to 17, I didn't know whether I was Arthur or Martha, or whether I was Catholic or non-Catholic or going to hell. I was definitely going to go to hell. There was no question about that. It was just when. It was a matter of when. And my soul was perpetually black. Because as a young child, when we made our first communion, we were told, if you left a sin out, that was a black mark on your soul. And prior to my first communion, I had said the words, bloody bugger. And my mother had washed my mouth out with soap for saying that. It was Lifebuoy soap, which had carbolic acid and God knows what. But she washed my mouth out for saying bloody bugger. And I thought, there is no way I can repeat that to a priest. There is no way. As a kid of five, I can say, bless me, Father, this is my first confession. I said bloody bugger. I retained that sin.
Black mark.
Black mark. Not only did I have a black mark for retaining the sin, I then went to communion. So I was in a state of sin going to communion. So double sin, double whammy. Now, that condition of my mind stayed with me right through school. That I knew every time I went to confession or communion, I was actually in a state of mortal sin.
And you say the guilt and the psychological trauma of this has continued through your life.
Absolutely.
To 72.
Yeah, guilt. You know, I have a lot of Jewish friends, and I always say, the Jews invented guilt and the Catholics perfected it. You never get over it. You never recover from guilt. As I have become older And I've read the Bible and I've read Buddha and I've read Sufi and various things like that. Even if you go to the point of, say, Christ, and I know I'm talking on a Christian radio station and I'm not trying to win votes, but I want to make a point.
Yeah, sure, sure.
I want to make a point. Christ didn't talk like that.
This was my question. How on earth did we get from Christ to that?
Love ye one another.
Yes.
And you know, the Sermon on the Mount is extraordinary. And all the things that you read that Christ said, whether you're a Christian or not, you can't dispute those. And you find those sorts of things in the Quran as well. And you'll find them in the teachings of Buddha and the like. So how is it that the Catholic Church thought it was okay to flog kids and to psychologically abuse kids and to sexually abuse kids, that that was okay? How could that have been?
I'm no shrink, but as I read through all this, I was sickened by it. I was shocked by it. I kept wondering whether in a way this equipped you with the resilience and ultimately the determination, the discipline, certainly the passion, to make the enormous difference you have in music and in the lives of people. I'm not saying it's a desirable way of achieving that, but you certainly have emerged as a resilient, passionate person.
Look, I often think about that and think in normal circumstances that would turn you off.
Of course.
So
that's my next question. I wonder how you ended up in the education system as a
I know.
Child.
I often think about that too, because there was nothing about school that was appealing. But I do remember a brother called Brother Joseph who asked me one day to look after a fourth class. And I got a real buzz out of that. Balance is really important in all of this. So in all of this hideousness, there was this Brother Joseph who said, come and take this class. And, you know, and he said, you did really well then. That could have been it. That could have been the thing that said,
it's okay.
It's okay.
Or it can be okay.
It can be okay. Nothing is ever entirely all bad or entirely all good, although we do know the bad things that happen, but and I think it's wrong to deny that. And the thing that concerns me a lot about the Catholic Church at the moment is that people are now coming out and saying, well, look, it really wasn't as bad as all that. This is now a beat up, etc., etc., etc. It's not a beat up.
No.
It is not a beat up.
This is why it's important for us to hear this.
It's incredibly serious. Yeah. It's a terribly, terribly serious thing. There are senior Catholic priests, senior Catholics at very, very high levels who need to address this and just not need to say, oh, look, we acknowledge that it happened. That's not enough to say we acknowledge that it happened.
Yes.
It needs to be addressed in really, really special ways.
Hear, hear. In your world of music, you've often cracked heads with bureaucracies and individuals on how best to educate kids in music. You're the originator of Baby Proms. After your wealth of these rich experiences, how should our schools and our parents be doing that? Connect kids with music.
The way to music for every child is through singing. You don't need an instrument. You need to start with the voice. Most people, in most circumstances, given normal children, etc., can sing. Singing and dancing simultaneously are incredibly important for the body. Singing is how children learn all the musical concepts. They learn rhythm, they learn pitch, they learn harmony, they learn to memorize, they learn text, they learn pattern, they learn to improvise, they can accompany themselves with instruments, with classroom instruments, percussion instruments, they can learn to compose. So that when they get to learning an instrument, all of that groundwork is done. The reason so many children give up instruments is too much information has to be taught at once. So if you go along as a child learning violin at the age of 4 or 5, for example, you've got to learn to hold the violin, hold the bow, hold your wrist, read the music, find the strings, etc., etc., etc. It's too much. Yeah. Any child who sings and has a rich background in song and pitch has an advantage in all instrumental instruction. Singing is absolutely the basis of it. That is not my idea. That is not an original thought. I promise you. That's been known since the year 800. So why we don't do it universally in this country is beyond me. And it's not expensive. We're not asking parents to pitch out millions of dollars for instruments. There's a human voice there already.
Which leads me to your grand passion for opera. in which you've held numbers of significant roles. What is it about opera and the music of opera that so captivates you?
Opera is a walking disaster. Opera is like, it really is. Of all the musical styles, nothing is more difficult than opera. In every single circumstance with opera, you're dealing with characters whose entire output depends on a tiny muscle in their throats. It can be too hot in the studio. It can be too cold in the studio. I can wake up with a sore throat. I can go to bed with a sore throat, but wake up feeling fine. I won't be singing this much today. I'll be just taking a little bit of a rest here. I think I've got a temperature. Multiply that by the number of people in the cast. And you've got a kindergarten on your hands. And you've got a room full of divas. And then you've got an orchestra having the same sorts of issues.
And you want to lead these people?
Yeah, well, it's irresistible because, I'll tell you why, because when you're standing in the pit, and the orchestra's there, and they're on stage, and it's powering. It's one of the most exciting things in the whole world. And making these people feel comfortable, the job of the opera conductor is to make the people on stage do the very best they can, and let them do that, feel as if they can do that. In my rehearsal rooms, I've always run the room to make the singers feel as comfortable as possible. In other words, it's okay to make a mistake. It doesn't matter if you screw up. It doesn't matter if you forget some words. It doesn't matter if you forget some music. We can sort that out, but just keep giving us this beautiful voice. And the idea is to encourage them to do their best all the time. And you get great performances from people, and that's what I love.
Wonderful stuff. Can I ask you briefly about two specific musical experiences of many thousands? First, one from opera, which provides quite an insight into how ruthless and just plain bitchy this wonderful world of music can be. One particular performance of Turandot.
I was conducting Turandot for the Australian Opera. Turandot was being sung by a really special diva called Leona Mitchell, wonderful, wonderful singer. Doing Turandot for the first time and very concerned that she do it as brilliantly as possible, knowing that people like Maria Callas had sung Turandot, big stars have sung Turandot, and she was a big star. Leona was a big star. So we're doing okay in the rehearsal period. And then one night, it was in the second act when Turandot comes down and sings her very first aria, which is in Questa Regia, in this kingdom. It's a nightmare for the Turandots. It's one of the most difficult arias in the repertoire. It's a tough piece to sing. And I turned over and it wasn't there. The aria wasn't there. And it had been lifted from my score.
Somebody pinched it.
Yeah, quite neatly.
Deliberately.
Well, I have to believe it was deliberate because I wouldn't do it.
No.
Why would I?
You've never done it before.
No,
or
exactly.
Since, I'm sure.
And it's like sort of letting your life jacket run out of air. That is the crucial point of the act. I turned over and there was no aria. And at that moment, and I thought, okay, look, I know this aria. I know where the chorus comes. I mustn't let her see that I'm panicked out of my mind.
No.
And we're on radio. Otherwise, you can think of all sorts of other things one might say.
Yes.
But I thought, I've got to let this diva know that everything is just fine. I looked down and I turned again and I thought, okay, I know where that will be. But what worried me was, what else is missing?
Oh, yes.
I thought maybe something else is gone. But if you were going to lift something from that particular opera, and if you were going to hope that a conductor would fall on his face, that's what you'd take.
So that's what they were trying to do, just set you up.
Yeah. I believe I was being set up to fail deliberately.
Why?
I can only think jealousy.
It's just how it is.
It's just how it is. Yeah. And it was not a loose leaf. It was not something that fell out of the score.
No.
And I guarded those scores. From now on, I always take my scores out of the pit. Now, I never leave it in the pit.
Yeah.
So I can only think, Lee, all the evidence points to the fact that it was lifted deliberately.
Thank you. Second musical experience, David Helfgott's first main public outing. You were the conductor.
Yep.
What was the process and the performance like?
Well, you've got to love David Helfgott, right?
Oh, yes.
We love David Helfgott. Yeah. And there's no question about his extraordinary musical ability and his fantastic memory. If we're totally frank, the performances are not always as accurate as you would like them, but that's really not the point at one stage. But what was interesting was David has this lovely way of saying things 45 times in a row. When he came into to the room to have my first rehearsal. Oh, Richard, oh, we're going to do the Greek, glorious Greek, oh, Richard. Which is very health god.
Yes, yes.
And he had God knows how many cigarettes in his hand and how many cups of coffee. And we started to rehearse. I thought, oh my God, will we ever get this on? Will we ever get there? And it came to the night of the concert. I'd opened the program with the Puccini Gloria Mass. And I saw Helfgott, I went off stage, and I saw Helfgott walking away from the stage, heading out the back of the concert hall towards the river. I raced after him. I said, David, we're getting to the Greek. Oh, the glorious Greek. I walked with him to the entrance of the stage, and I shoved him on stage, and the house went wild. You've never heard anything like it. We started the Grieg, which you know starts with a drum roll and then a big piano cadenza. Dum, da, da, dum, da, da, dum, da, dum. Yep. Well, on that way down in that cadenza, he covered a lot of other material as well. So, which was very interesting.
Yes.
And I thought, oh my God, here we go. The first movement was spectacular. Mm. Second movement was really lyrical and beautiful. And we'd had discussions about the speed of the third movement because he wanted to go like the clappers.
Yes.
And I said, David, we can't keep up. And he started the third movement and he knew there was nothing I could do about it. And he just went like the wind. And I looked over at one of the bass players and she looked at me and said, he got ya. So we kept up.
And you got there.
We got there.
What a relief at the end of it.
Yeah, it was extraordinary. The house went mad.
Yeah.
It was an unbelievable night.
Notwithstanding all the inevitable slings and arrows you've experienced, that anyone would during a lifetime of music and education and performance, what has kept you going through all this?
I think it's trying to do it properly. You always think you'll never do it properly and it's never good enough. I sweat every note of every concert I'm about to do about I can't do it. I don't know the music well enough and all this goes through my mind. I find I'm getting harder and harder and harder on myself. I look back and think I don't believe I had the gall to do what I did 30 years ago. There's something about youth which I think shields you, and there's something about the autumn of one's life, if you like, which allows you to look at that and say, you escaped quite well there.
Yeah. And you're doing it for others.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah. The most important thing for me about music is the music. Whereas I was motivated early in my life about me, I wanted to be a world-famous concert pianist. Though all the order is wrong, world-famous concert pianist. Notice that pianist is last.
Yes.
Which is music is last, so it's about like 15 minutes of fame. I couldn't care less about 15 minutes of fame now, but about actually how does the music go.
Richard Gill, it's been an absolute pleasure catching up with you and speaking with you. I'm so grateful for you.
It's been my pleasure entirely.
Good on you.
We hope you enjoyed this Open House podcast. To hear more from Open House, visit openhousecommunity.com.au.